Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Prasky. Today, a story about a socialite who parachuted into France during World War II to hide weapons in preparation for D-Day, and who, by her own account, strangled a German sentry with her bare hands. Also today, the new look Kansas City Royals. Just how good are they going to be with all that new pitching? We'll find out. But first today, if your heart stops and you need CPR, the sad truth is you're more likely to survive in a well-to-do neighborhood than a poor neighborhood. Why is that? We're about to find out. Our guests today are Dr. Paul Chan. He's a cardiologist with the St. Luke's Health System. He's one of the researchers involved in a study published in October in the New England Journal of Medicine that examined this issue. And Dr. Chan, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
Also with us is Dr. Joe Salamone. He's medical director of the Kansas City, Missouri Fire Department. And Joe, good to have you too. Good morning.
Thank you.
Well, Paul, your study uncovered a disturbing finding. It found that people who went into cardiac arrest in a poor black neighborhood were half as likely to get CPR from a bystander before emergency personnel arrived, as were people in middle-income or wealthier white neighborhoods. What do you make of that?
So we were disturbed by those findings as well.
Yeah.
We know that all of us don't live in isolation. We live in communities. We live in neighborhoods. And we oftentimes see in the hospital people coming in with a cardiac arrest when patients' hearts stop and wonder what could have been done better or more for patients before they arrived at a hospital. And so we started thinking about this and looked at this in a national registry that collects data on cardiac arrest. This registry is sponsored, by the way, by the Centers for Disease Control and the American Heart Association. And it collects data on cardiac arrest from 29 communities in the United States.
Including Kansas City, right?
Including Kansas City, exactly. Mm-hmm. And then we classified communities by income and by race. And then we looked at what was the likelihood that a patient who arrested in a poor or a wealthy neighborhood or a primarily black, integrated, or a primarily white neighborhood, what was the probability of getting bystander CPR? And the reason why that is important is we know that one of the strongest predictors of whether or not a patient survives a cardiac arrest when they arrest outside the hospital is whether or not they have somebody start CPR before the paramedics arrive.
Mm.
And we found that patients who arrested in poor communities, whether or not they were wealthy or poor themselves, were much less likely to get CPR by a bystander than patients who arrested in a well-to-do community.
Hmm.
And if you were black, you were, again, less likely to get CPR. Excuse me, if you arrested in a black neighborhood, whether or not you were white or black, you were less likely to get CPR from a bystander. Such that if you arrested in a black, poor neighborhood, you had two strikes against you in terms of getting any emergency resuscitation before the paramedics arrived.
You know,
this
Jill,
is deeply disturbing, obviously, because it would explain in many ways why the survival rates from cardiac arrest in places like Detroit, which has a survival rate from cardiac arrest of 0.2%, that's one out of 500 people survive a cardiac arrest in Detroit, as compared to Seattle, where it's 16%. One out of six who have a cardiac arrest in Seattle survive.
You know, those numbers just blew me out the door.
That's an 80-fold difference.
Yeah. You know, Joe Salamone with the Kansas City Fire Department, how surprised were you by these findings? Were you surprised at all?
Well, certainly to see it on paper defined thoughts that we had been concerned with for years. But, since we have continuously kind of looked at cardiac arrest outcomes in our system for almost 20 years now, we've watched and followed our community's use of bystander CPR, and to have a disparity like this was not that surprising.
Because you see it every day, I imagine, in the community that you serve, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Even in spite of our dispatchers, when they identify a cardiac arrest, once equipment is en route to that person, We actually launch into what we call pre-arrival instructions, and we try over the phone to instruct bystanders, if they're not doing chest compressions, to start them. And even with that telephone instruction, we have found a significant reluctance to begin or to continue chest compression.
Well, that's interesting. That reluctance stems from what?
You know, I don't think any of us really understand that, and I don't think it's been well researched yet. And just, you know, with this current study that just came out, you know, I think it's clearly identified that difference is there, but we really need to kind of delve far deeper into what are the social stigmata of death and in different communities, in sub-communities in our cities, and then where people, you know, what is the reluctance for people to become involved, even with a loved one who collapses?
And do people tell your dispatchers over the phone, Joe, that, hey, I don't want to get involved in that? Do they verbalize it and say,
sometimes say,
thing.
I can't do that, I'm afraid to do that. And, you know, I think that there's one of the things where we see the new CPR hopefully moving a little bit past that. But
because the new CPR is simpler.
It is simpler, and it also avoids, particularly for the layperson, avoids mouth to mouth, and
right.
Which has been a significant concern for folks, particularly in the evolving area of a better understanding and higher concern about infectious disease. So folks were even more reluctant in the last decade or two to begin mouth to mouth, particularly on strangers.
Dr. Paul Chan with St. Luke's, are you surprised by this reluctance that Joe Salamone just described to us?
So, I think there was a study actually done 3 years ago, published in the cardiology journal called Circulation, and it took 911 calls from people who had witnessed a cardiac arrest. And as Joe mentioned, fewer than 40% of people who actually took the time to call 911 to seek emergency help, less than half the people who called in provided CPR, even though they called for help.
Well, that just floors me, Paul. That just floors me. Yeah.
And part of it, I think, as Joe mentioned, is the stigmata of mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, which is no longer part of what is recommended in CPR. We know now that doing just continuous chest compression is actually better as a bystander than doing mouth-to-mouth alternating with chest compressions. And there have been a number of studies that have validated this. The other issue is I think a lot of people just feel inadequate or threatened by having to do CPR. And one of the things that, we looked at in this study in terms of the neighborhood experience as to whether or not somebody would be likely to get CPR is it really the neighborhood in the sense that if I arrest it in a black or a poor neighborhood, is it that individuals who are in those communities, because they're in those communities, are less likely to provide CPR, or is it because they've received a lot less training to do CPR?
And what's the answer to that?
And we are actually looking at this right now. We're writing this paper up with colleagues at Duke University. And what we are doing is we've gathered data from all the training that the American Heart Association did in 1 year and all the training for CPR that the American Red Cross has done over the same year. And then we have, again, mapped them to specific counties and looked at CPR training rates and whether or not the training rates are higher or lower in different communities. And not surprisingly, we are finding that communities that are black, communities that are poor, communities that are rural or in the South are much less likely to get training from the American Heart Association and the American Red Cross. So this raises, obviously, a red flag. Whenever we think about disparities in care, whether they're racial disparities or income disparities, we struggle with the fact, as researchers, as physicians, as paramedics, what we can do about disparities, because oftentimes we can't change the race of the patient. We can't change, oftentimes, the income of the patient. The neighborhood experience in this study that we did raises an opportunity, specifically if it is due to the fact that we're not training people to do CPR in poor or black communities, that suggests an opportunity to improve. we can actually do more training, and we can change the dynamics of that disparity. And so even though these findings are incredibly disturbing, they raise an opportunity where we can actually reverse the disparity.
Joe, in your experience, is this lack of training that Dr. Chan is talking about, is this apparent to you when it comes to where certain people live in the Kansas City area?
It certainly is, and I think not only has it helped us recognize that there is a disparity in training, but perhaps our training models need to change, and that we really need to look at, rather than formalized classroom, you get a merit badge, you get a card when you're done and pay a fee, that we need to look into communities and go into community events, go into churches, sporting events, any place you can get people together and simply, gather them around and teach them that, you can do no harm. If doing nothing is far worse than doing anything, and doing any chest compressions is better than doing nothing. And here's how you start. Call 911, then start pushing on the chest. And
yeah.
I think it just has to be a new model, too, of the delivery of the instruction.
Again, we're talking about – yeah, go ahead, Dr. Chan.
I would wholeheartedly agree with that. We need to find creative opportunities and venues. We also need to make them both culturally appropriate and literacy appropriate. We know that communities, people who live in communities that happen to be of lower income or of minority race, have a lower literacy level. And I actually just recertified in my CPR training recently, and I was amazed at the level of literacy required to go through the documents themselves.
Yeah.
And that is a barrier oftentimes for people signing up in classes. And so we need to think of other ways to get people involved. We need to get schools involved. If we can introduce CPR formally in elementary school and in high schools, in a decade from now, we can have almost everyone trained.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about this about CPR and this idea that if you're more likely to survive in a well-to-do neighborhood than a poor neighborhood for a whole host of reasons. We're visiting with Dr. Paul Chan from St. Luke's Health System and Dr. Joe Salamone, he's a medical director of the Kansas City, Missouri Fire Department, about all of this. We're wondering if you've ever received CPR, or perhaps maybe you've performed it. We'd like to hear your experience. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. And Joe, before we leave this segment, if people leave anything from what we're talking about here, it's that there's this idea now that CPR is far simpler to perform than it used to be. You don't have to do the mouth-to-mouth stuff. It's chest compressions that are so important. Do you want to just talk for a moment about what you do? Just guide us through it just for a minute.
Sure, absolutely. If you see somebody collapse or you come upon somebody who's collapsed, you shake them, yell at them, scream at them. If they do not respond, the very first thing is pull out your cell phone or call for help so you get the EMS system activated and folks – you can get people coming to help you. And the second thing is make sure they're flat on their back. Put your hands one on top of the other right in the center of their breastbone, right in the center of their chest, between the nipples and breasts, and start pushing. Push hard, push fast. And you can sing in, row, row, row your boat is one song that people sing. Another is the old Bee Gees disco tune, Staying Alive, kind of ironic to do that one. But it's really the goal is that you need people to start compressions, and any compression is better than none. You don't stop until the person tells you to stop or EMS gets there to take over for you.
And so, again, don't worry about the mouth-to-mouth stuff and pinching the nose and all of that. You're saying just start the compressions.
You just start compressions, absolutely.
And you do them what? Just how often and how continuously?
It's about 100 times a minute, and you just keep pressing until you're too tired, till somebody takes over for you or EMS arrives.
Well, Dr. Chan, you sort of wonder why, this whole idea of CPR, it used to be more complicated. Why was it more complicated? Because why wasn't it simple coming out of the gate?
It's a good question. I think there was a lot less evidence than three decades ago, when a lot of the earlier basic life support training for CPR was developed. And I think a lot of people had different ideas as to what might work. And over the last couple of decades, we've learned that some of those things don't work at all.
Mm.
And some of the things we were doing actually harmed or was not as helpful, such as if we took the time to give mouth-to-mouth breaths, what's really happening is we are interrupting CPR.
Mm.
We're stopping blood flow to the brain, to the vital organs of the body. And it is so much more important to just continue perfusing and getting blood flow to all the vital organs. The oxygen level in the blood doesn't go down very, very low until at least a few minutes have passed. And usually by that time, EMS has arrived to help
right.
assist with giving the breaths besides continuing CPR. And we've learned that when people try to give mouth-to-mouth breaths, it can lead to as much as a 30-second, even 60-second downtime,
yeah.
where somebody's getting nothing.
Huh. And Joe, I gather that proper training is always a good thing, but I think one message I'm picking up here is that with this continuous chest compression method, you don't really need to be trained. You can just do it, right?
Right, absolutely. And that's part of the premise of even the pre-arrival instructions over the phone, talking to somebody who's never done it before. You can, you know, anybody can do this, and you don't need a lot of training to do it and do it very well and correctly. And
okay.
You know, we used to spend, and I'm sure Paul remembers the days where we spent hours perfecting the timing, perfecting the exchanges, perfecting the, you know, where we put the breaths in, what the ratio of breaths to compressions were, and all those things, though very good ideas, really delayed, as Paul said, the most important thing was his perfusion, circulation,
yeah.
and that's really the key.
I remember all that as being kind of complicated,
right.
and now to hear you're simplifying it seems like such a great message here. Let's go to some phone calls. Lots of folks want to talk about CPR here. Chuck from Overland Park, good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for having this. This is a very important segment, and I must say, having lifeguard training and going into even a small emergency situation, which my mother had fallen down the stairs, I think it is very important that people take some type of, you know, first aid or, you know, CPR-type classes. It gives them a little bit more focus when it comes to, you know, an emergency situation. It gives them something to think about instead of freaking out. Now, with my questions, I have two. One is with regards to the chest compressions. I heard about this a few years ago. Now, is this endorsed both by the American Heart Association and by the American Red Cross?
Joe's yes. nodding his head, yes.
Yes, actually both. And the American Heart Association came out about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago now, and branded it as hands-only CPR. And so that is, in the past, though, it's been, you know, actually about 10 years ago in the Kansas City community, we started to try to initiate this. Dr. Gordon Avey from Sarver Heart Institute in Arizona came. Ann Peterson, a local, broadcaster, was
right.
very involved. And we started, and they were trying to promote the call and pump program. Very same thing. You know, call EMS, call 911, begin chest compressions. So it is endorsed, particularly for the lay person rescuer.
You had a second question too, Chuck.
The other question I had for you was, is there still a value of taking some of these courses? Now, when I was taking them, a lot of people were talking about the Good Samaritan Clause now, and I don't expect any legal advice here. But as far as taking formal training and getting that certification card, is there a value to that?
Dr. Chan, why don't you take that one?
So, you know, I think there is definitely a value. I would say that the cost can sometimes be a barrier for patients, and that might also go back to the point I made earlier in terms of the rates of training of CPR by communities that are largely minority versus non-minority or wealthy or poor. We need to find ways of lowering the barriers of cost to communities, especially disadvantaged communities that have much worse outcomes. Any of us who have loved ones, whether parents who are aging, children or infants, in many ways, it would almost be incumbent upon all of us to want to do CPR, because if anything should ever happen and we're in the room or on the streets with our loved ones, we would want to be able to take action. We would want to be able to provide something rather than feel helpless.
You know, Joe,
Go ahead.
Joe, I'm just wondering this question of legal liability that Dr. Chan just mentioned. You know, should people be worried about that if they do it and they screw it up where the patient doesn't survive? Is there some legal liability here that people might wonder about?
You know, I think almost every state has some Good Samaritan law that covers you under these extraordinary circumstances. And again, doing nothing, the likelihood that patient will survive approaches zero. Mm-hmm. So, you know, doing anything is beneficial, and certainly ignoring or hesitating to start will contribute more than actually starting any kind of chest compressions.
I want to go to Meredith from Kansas City, Missouri, who has a question about cost. We were just talking about that. Meredith, go ahead.
Hi. I've had the CPR training mostly through work for most of the last 15 years, but last couple of years I haven't been able to find a job, and I would love to recertify, but I can't afford it. And I know that that's a concern for a lot of people. And you know, when the first time I ever did CPR was actually, they had some sort of a big group thing at Kauffman Stadium when I was like 12 or 13. And I think something like that was pretty cool. Although when I was in my early 20s, I was in a restaurant and somebody was choking. And I remember standing there going, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I'm afraid that I might hurt her.
Yes.
And, you know, so I think that, you know, I do think that there is value in having the training, because then you know the things you said, like the Good Samaritan laws, and you know that, you know, doing something is better than doing nothing, and you feel more confident about it, but it's just not within everybody's reach.
Let me just find out, where can you go for free training, Joe Solomon?
I don't know the answer to that question, although we are, and hopefully actually going to hear tomorrow, the Kansas City Fire Department has applied for a grant for the Greater Health Foundation of Kansas City to begin a program where we put training materials on every fire apparatus and with every community contact for handing out smoke detectors, doing anything where we're in folks' homes, that we're going to have crews offer that training.
Paul Chan, where can you go for free training? Do you have any more ideas on that?
Well, that's oftentimes the barrier, I think, for a lot of people. Oftentimes the best way to get training is when a church or a school or some entity is able to arrange for training for a large number of people so that the cost can be either divided amongst the participants, and so the cost is much lower, or potentially subsidized. We've been under efforts to try to advocate, at least with the American Heart Association, to waive costs for disadvantaged populations, and the verdict is still out. But I understand the dilemma that a lot of people face in terms of not having employer-subsidized training and where to find it. And that's one of the reasons why I think it is so important to see if we can find ways to get it in the schools for young kids. But that doesn't solve the problem for the adults in the meantime.
No. Carol writes us this on KCUR's Facebook page. I've long believed that if CPR were taught in the schools, that within a generation or two, everyone would be familiar with it. The rules keep changing, but the basics remain the same. And again, Joe, you're hoping that that begins to change in Kansas City, Missouri.
Absolutely. Under MAST, formerly, we had just begun some programs in area high schools where we were going in for free and beginning this training in high schools. But as Paul said, I really think we need to start this even younger. Started in elementary education, then reinforce it throughout their school years, so that again we are graduating generations of folks that have this ingrained with us as much as stop, drop, and roll for fires.
Paul, you're good with the numbers here. In terms of stats, how often does someone who has received CPR survive the experience? Do we know about that?
So there's sort of two survival numbers. One is, what's the likelihood of surviving to the hospital? And then what is the likelihood of surviving to leave the hospital?
Okay.
And again, as I mentioned, it varies by communities, but the strongest predictors of whether or not somebody survives both to the hospital and leaves the hospital alive is, number one, whether or not they get CPR by a bystander before the paramedics arrive. Number two, whether or not they get quick defibrillation, a quick shock of the rhythm, if they have a rhythm that can be brought back to normal with a defibrillator. And number three, whether or not the rhythm is something called a ventricular arrhythmia. Those are the three major predictors. The one thing we can change as members of the public is CPR by bystanders. And if you can become familiarized as to where the AEDs are located in your communities, then prompt defibrillation can be also within your hands as well. The rates of survival to a hospital for all cardiac arrests is less than 50%. And on average, across all communities in the United States, about, depending upon which source you use, 4%, maybe 5% of patients who have a cardiac arrest make it out alive.
Mm-hmm.
But it's much higher in some communities. In Seattle, it's 16%. In Phoenix recently, they've done a huge public awareness campaign to train people and to do early hands-on CPR, and the rates have tripled over the last decade in terms of survival. And so we are seeing communities, pockets in the United States
right.
that are taking the political will and translating it into saved lives.
Susan writes us this, I'm a CPR instructor. Why don't we have a volunteer-based community program that is corporate-sponsored for the layperson to get trained? Many of us instructors would teach for free. We just need the resources, time, and support to launch a program, maybe an annual CPR training for one day. Venue could be, say, Arrowhead Stadium. Your thoughts, Joe?
Oh, I think absolutely. And I think, you know, again, you know, Kauffman Foundation funded that once many years ago. And
why not do it again, eh?
I think I'm sure there are philanthropists out there that are looking for something that perhaps just haven't heard that. I'd like to just follow up Paul's comments just very briefly, just so folks know the Kansas City, Missouri community. We have been using continuous chest compression model for our actual EMS system now for 6 years, and we are one of the CARES cities. And our CARES data for this year, we run about 11% survival to hospital discharge, so well above the national norm, still trying to get to Seattle's numbers. And for folks who have a witnessed arrest and somebody does CPR, twice as many leave the hospital. Up to 66% will leave the hospital if they have bystander CPR.
Steve from Raytown has a story for us. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. I'm a member of the Kansas City Metro Chorus, and we were singing a concert out in Lee's Summit on August 12th, and our director, after directing our first piece.
Oh, I think we just lost him by we're going to have to end our segment there. I'm going to thank Dr. Paul Chan. He's with St. Luke's Health System. And Dr. Joe Salamone, he's medical director of the Kansas City, Missouri Fire Department. Hey, thank you both for coming in and offering us some great advice. I'm really glad to have it.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
You bet. Thanks, guys.